United States of Horror
may contain some graphic
or explicit content.
Listener discretion is advised. Are you ready?
Are you ready?
Is the microphone right? Yes.
Are you sure it's right?
Yes.
Are you sure it's in? Deanna, part two.
Oh, gosh. Back at you guys.
Prepare for trouble and make it double.
It's worse this week.
It's worse?
Yeah.
So if you missed it last week, what did we do, Kaylee?
We talked about this really horribly sad, gruesome...
Abuse,
tragic abuse that Sylvia Likens went through. And to fully grasp the scope of everything, you really need to go back and listen to part one. And I'm so sorry that we're giving you another several part, well, it's going to be two parts, but another parted out episode, but it's the best way to
deal with this long.
Yeah, because it would not have all fit in one episode. I mean, it could have, but.
Want to hear the good news?
What's the good news?
At least after your story, oh, and no, my stupidity.
Yeah, so we'll have a little bit of a happier ending this week.
Just a little bit.
Just a little.
Last week was really sad. This part of this week was really sad.
To, like, explain to you guys, I was pretty much crying.
She was crying.
I was pretty much crying. Like, I'm trying. Yeah, anyway.
This girl, she watches all these sick murderers, horror movies. She laughs at everything. But
Don't make me sound like a psychopath, because I don't laugh.
Hello, Georgie.
That is not true. I don't laugh, but I can stomach it. I can get through it. I normally don't bat an eye because, like...
You're desensitized.
I've desensitized, but I think I also, like, just... I put a wall up. I disassociate from it, you know? Okay, anyway. Regardless, I was crying and, you know... I think I had to stop where we did.
Yeah, it was really taking a toll on her. So I'm Jeff, and this is Kaylee.
And we are
the United States of Horror. Yes, we're the best.
I don't think we did that last week.
Are you sure? We did it on the end.
We did do it at the end. So. You're right. So you're hearing it again if you're binge listening.
Yeah, you binge. All right, you better binge. You like binging to my voice.
If you do, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, too. You should take a shot every time you hear "Shut up, Jeff."
They're listening to multiple episodes, then they're gonna get alcohol poisoning.
One day, someone's make a collab with all.
Another week, another episode, and Jeff is giving bad advice already. Not even 5 minutes in.
So every time you hear a car drive by, you take a shot.
Jeff, shut up.
If you live in the city, you're shut out of luck. Sorry, you're crap out of luck.
I wonder if they can hear the cicadas.
Every time you hear a cicada in one of our episodes, you take a shot. Every time you hear the cat in one of our episodes, you take a shot.
That's a lot.
You guys are going to die from alcohol poisoning.
Anyway, I mean, I still have a little, not a little, I have a good chunk of information to get through, so we can just go ahead and, like,
go right through it.
Dive into it, if you will.
Let's do it.
So, it was already bad last week. And it doesn't get any better. It's very sad. We go through the details of everything. And we have the initial warning. Maybe I should have put a more extensive warning at the beginning of last week's episode. But I'm just letting you know now that it's still very sad. It's rough. So just be prepared. So I'm going to jump into it. Are we good? Do we have anything to discuss?
I think everyone is amazing, and thank you for all the support. You know who you are, and keep listening.
Yeah.
And be my friend, because I need friends right now.
Talk to us.
Talk to me only, no one else.
We'll say more at the end.
Yes.
So, on October 25th, Likens attempted to escape from the basement, and that's where we left her last week, is she was in the basement after a brutal beating. So she attempted to escape after overhearing a conversation between Gertrude and John Benzuski. I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher the names again. Junior, pertaining to the family's plan to abandon her to die. So she actually overhears this. And it's already bad enough. She's been beaten and starved and...
tortured and humiliated.
Humiliated. But to hear their plan to literally kill her... devastating. So she attempted to flee to the front door, although due to her extensive injuries and general weakness, Gertrude caught her before she could escape the property. Likens was given toast to eat, but was unable to consume the food due to her extreme state of dehydration. Gertrude forced the toast into her mouth before repeatedly striking her face with a curtain rod until sections of the instrument were bent into right angles.
No, I don't like when people use math on people. I don't want it. I couldn't do math last week, and now this. I don't like math anymore.
It's like that guy's shirt all over again.
Yes. Oh my gosh. No. We're like, what? No. Okay. Never mind. Ugh. Color is the dress, Kaylee. Yellow and gold.
Yellow and gold?
Yeah. White and gold.
White and gold. It's white and gold.
Yeah.
That's what I always said.
Is it? Okay. We're on the same page with that. Those are shoes that we're off on.
Yeah, they're white and pink.
No, they're not.
I'm going to punch you.
Please.
Coy Hubbard then took the curtain rod from Gertrude and struck Likens one further time, rendering her unconscious. Gertrude then dragged Likens into the basement, and that evening, Likens desperately attempted to alert neighbors by screaming for help and hitting the walls of the basement with a spade. One immediate neighbor of the Banzuskis, whatever, would later inform police that she had heard the desperate commotion and that she had identified the source as emanating from the basement of 3850 East New York Street, but that as the noise had suddenly ceased at approximately 3 a.m., she decided not to inform police about the disturbance.
So this stupid neighbor, I kept hearing screaming and crying for help, but I just ignored it
until it went away. But it just stopped abruptly, so...
Still, if you hear someone crying, banging on something...
Especially if it stops abruptly.
Especially with all your neighbors, whenever you have mailbox meeting, like, oh, did you hear about the beating? Oh, I heard about the beating. Did you see the black eyes on that girl? Yeah, I haven't seen her in a while. I think she was in the basement. Yeah, I heard screaming. Oh, that's all right.
You're telling me that nobody took notice of this and paid attention.
And no one wanted to inform anyone of this to the authorities or to anyone else. No one cares. Sorry, guys. I got really angry.
No, it's frustrating. It's so frustrating. So, I'm just going to keep going. By the morning of October 26th, Likens was unable to either speak intelligibly or to correctly coordinate the movement of her limbs. Gertrude did move Likens into the kitchen and, having propped her back against a wall, attempted to feed her a donut and a glass of milk. Although she threw Likens to the floor in frustration when Likens was unable to correctly move the glass of milk to her limbs.
To
her lips. She was then returned to the basement. Shortly after, Likens became delirious, repeatedly moaning and mumbling. When Paula asked her to recite the English alphabet, Likens was unable to recite anything beyond the first four letters or to raise herself off the ground. In response, Paula verbally threatened her to stand up or she would herself inflict a long jump upon her. What does that even mean?
In which athletes combine speed, strength, and...
Like a literal long jump? Yeah. Like, run and jump on her?
Yeah. You know, when they jump over the sand into...
This entire family is just trash.
This isn't WWE, dude.
No, this isn't the Olympics. This is like, they're looking for a gold medal for torture. They would have won it, too. Gertrude then ordered Likens, who had defecated, to clean herself. The afternoon, several of Likens' other tormentors gathered in the basement. Likens jerkingly moved her arms in an apparent attempt to point at the faces of the tormentors she could recognize, making statements such as, "You're Ricky," and "You're Gertie," before Gertrude tersely shouted, "Shut up, you know who I am." Minutes later, Likens unsuccessfully attempted to bite into a rotten pear she had been given to eat, stating she could feel the looseness in her teeth.
Oh, I have those dreams.
And the fact that it was a rotten pear?
Yeah, she couldn't do that. Oh, no.
Upon hearing this, Jenny replied, "Don't you remember, Sylvia? Your front tooth was knocked out when you were 7. Jenny then left Sylvia in the basement to perform gardening chores for the neighbors in the hope of earning spending money. In an attempt to wash Likens, a laughing John Benzinski Jr. sprayed her with a garden hose brought to the house that afternoon by Randy Leper, at Gertrude's request. Lykins again desperately attempted to exit the basement, but collapsed before she could reach the stairs. In response to this effort, Gertrude stamped upon Lykins' head before standing and staring at her for several moments.
Oh. Kaylee, why are you doing this to me? Why are you doing this to everyone?
I told you it got worse. Guys, I warned you.
We need to find these people and we need to teach them a lesson.
Well, they kind of...
Okay.
All dead, but...
I need to take a second. Keep going. I'll try to hold in my anger.
You're gonna get more angry. Stephanie then decided to give Lykins a warm, soapy bath, although Lykins ceased breathing before she could be carried out of the basement. She was 16 years old when she died.
Don't cry, Kaylee.
I'm sorry. I'm not gonna cry.
I'm crying. You're crying.
When Stephanie realized that Lykins was not breathing, she attempted to apply mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. As Gertrude repeatedly shouted her belief to the children and teenagers present in her house that Lykins was faking her death.
Guys, let's go take care of business.
They're dead, Jeff. They're already dead.
Good. I don't care. We'll dig up their bodies, destroy their bones, grind them up like Jeffrey Dahmer did. Okay.
Shortly after 5:30 p.m., Richard Hobbs returned to the Bansuski's residence and immediately proceeded to the basement. He slipped on the wet basement stairs and fell heavily to the floor of the basement to be confronted with the sight of Stephanie crying and cuddling Lycan's emaciated and lacerated body. You do not deserve the right to cry over her dead body. You have zero right to be crying.
You helped do that. You caused someone.
I mean,
torture.
I understand the children were under the influence of their mother. However,
you should understand to a certain degree some of the actions.
Okay. Gertrude initially accused Lykins of feigning death. She struck her body with a book, shouting, "Faker! Faker!" to rouse her. Then, panicking, instructed Richard Hobbs to call the police from a nearby payphone. The police arrived at her address at approximately 6:30 p.m. Gertrude led the officers to Lykins' emaciated and extensively bludgeoned and mutilated body lying upon a soiled mattress in one of the bedrooms before handing them the letter she had forced Lykins to previously write to her dictation. Also claiming she had been doctoring the child for an hour or more prior to her death, having applied rubbing alcohol to Lykins' wounds in a futile attempt at first aid before she had died.
Of course she would try to be like, I was trying to be a hero. Of course she was.
Yeah. She added that Lykins had earlier run away from her home with several teenage boys and returned to the house earlier that afternoon, bare-breasted and clutching the note. Clutching a Bible, Paula Bansuski, having stated to all present in the household that Lykins' death was meant to happen, then glanced in Jenny's direction and calmly stated, "If you want to live with us, Jenny, we'll treat you like your own sister." Like our own sister.
Oh.
Like our own sister.
I know we just destroyed your sister and killed an innocent person.
She literally said that she was supposed to die. Like, that she was meant to die.
And that you're supposed to be our sister.
Trash. They're just trash.
They're all trash. They're all caca. Anyway.
I'm gonna throw up.
I'm gonna fight someone soon.
Another episode full of long...
silence.
Pauses that I have to edit out. As previously instructed by Gertrude, Jenny Lykins recited the rehearsed version of events leading to Lykins' death shortly after 5:30 p.m. that afternoon to police before whispering to the officers, "You get me out of here and I'll tell you everything." Good girl. Finally. Finally. The formal statement provided by Jenny Likens prompted officers to arrest Gertrude, Paula, Stephanie, and John Bensushkri Jr. on suspicion of Likens' murder within hours of the discovery of her body. Finally. Finally.
They're all going down. I hope they do.
The same day, Coy Hubbard and Richard Hobbs were also arrested and charged with the same offenses. The three eldest children, plus Coy Hubbard, were placed in the custody of a nearby juvenile detention center. The younger children and Richard Hobbs were detained at the Indianapolis Children's Guardian Home. All were held without bail pending trial.
Good.
Initially, Gertrude denied any involvement in Likens' death, although on October 27th, she had confessed to having known the kids, particularly her daughter Paula and Coy Hubbard, had physically and emotionally abused Likens, stating that Paula did most of the damage and that Coy Hubbard did a lot of the beating.
So this person, this piece of...
Not only
she killed someone else's child, then she threw her own children under the bus.
She's throwing her own kids under the bus. She's trying to...
get out of everything.
By blaming her children.
They did everything. I'm totally innocent. I'll just try and protect him and do all that.
Can you get any worse? Like, there are a lot of really bad mothers out there, Casey Anthony being one of them, but she is, like, at the top.
That is... oh.
At the top.
Gertrude, you are scum.
You're the scum between my toes.
Gertrude, you are scum. You're not a good trash panda. You are the worst trash panda.
So Gertrude further admitted to having forced the girl to sleep in the basement on approximately 3 occasions when she had wet the bed. She became evasive when one officer stated that the likely reasons Likens had become incontinent were her mental distress and injury to her kidneys. Lacking any remorse, Paula signed a statement admitting having repeatedly beaten Sylvia about the backside with her mother's police belt. Also, once breaking her wrist on Sylvia's jaw and inflicting other acts of brutality, including pushing her down the stairs into the basement 2 or 3 times, and inflicting a black eye.
That's it. Just pushing them down the stairs a couple times in black eye and all this stuff. No big deal.
John Jr. admitted to having spanked Sylvia on one occasion, adding that most of the time I used my fists to abuse her.
So I just spanked her once, but I did beat her with my fists. I'm sorry, guys, I keep saying it over and over again, but I'm getting really angry.
I'm telling you, it only gets worse.
How does it get worse?
Because we're going to go over the autopsy.
Oh, man. Okay, go ahead.
So, John Jr. also admitted to having burned Sylvia with matches on several occasions, adding that his mother had repeatedly burned the child with cigarettes. 5 other neighborhood children who had participated in Likens' abuse, Michael Monroe, Randy Lepper, Darlene McGuire, Judy Duke, and Anna Sisko, had also been arrested by October 29th. So they're making multiple arrests, which is good.
Good. Anyone who knew anything at all, did anything, needs to go down.
So all of them were charged with causing injury to person, and each was subsequently released into the custody of their parents under subpoena to appear as witness at the upcoming trial.
So it was either you testify against these people,
or you're charged.
Which
is smart.
Yeah, which
you can get. Because then they have a really solid case.
Yeah.
So.
That or everyone's going down potentially.
Yeah. The autopsy is rough.
Really?
Just like the rest of the story. But it's rough. So, the autopsy of Likens' body revealed she had suffered in excess of 150 separate wounds across her entire body, in addition to being extremely emaciated at the time of her death. The wounds themselves varied in location, nature, severity, and actual stage of healing. Her injuries included burns, severe bruising, and extensive muscle and nerve damage. Her vaginal cavity was almost swollen shut. Hmm. She was 16.
Yeah.
Despite that, the examination of the canal determined that her hymen was still intact. So, this discredited Gertrude's assertions that Likens had been 3 months pregnant, a prostitute, and promiscuous. So, everything that Gertrude was trying to say about her was basically
false. It's false.
It's false, but it was also destroyed.
Yeah.
Moreover, all of Likens' fingernails were broken backwards. And I don't know why, but that gets me... Ugh. Like, you know, in movies, whenever they're like horror movies and they're clawing, oh god, I can't even think about it. I can't say it. I'm gonna throw up.
Like on the chalkboard.
Nope, stop, please. It's whenever, like, have you seen The Ring?
Yeah.
Whenever she's trying to get out and like her nail, ugh.
Like, going against the wall.
Stop, and the I'm gonna door die. And the, around it's the not door. Even just a scratching, but it's like whenever it gets bent backwards or bent off.
Yeah.
Okay. Most of the external layers of skin upon the child's face, breast, neck, right knee, and right knee had peeled or receded. In her death throes, Likens had evidently bitten through her lips, partially severing sections of them from her face. The official cause of Likens' death was listed by coroner Dr. Arthur Keeble as a subdural hematoma due to receiving a severe blow to her right temple. Both the shock had primarily... She had primarily suffered due to the severe and prolonged damage inflicted to her skin and subcutaneous tissue, which is basically the layer of cells beneath the skin. Plus, the severe malnutrition were listed as contributing factors to her death. So, rigor mortis had fully developed at the time of the discovery of her body, indicating Likens may have been deceased for up to 8 hours before she was found. Although Dr. Keeble did note that Likens had recently bathed, possibly after death, and that this act could have hastened the loss of body temperature and thus speeding the onset of rigor mortis.
They knew they messed up, so they tried to make it look as innocent as possible.
They tried, but failed, because obviously an investigation with a body looking like that, like...
And, like, what...
Stupid.
And, like, what they should have noticed, or, like, the stupid people, they should know that people were going to do an investigation and see, oh, the body had this amount of damage for this long ago.
Yeah.
From months ago. Not yeah. just, oh, it happened all one, two nights.
Isn't it amazing that they can do that? They can look yeah. at a bruise or like a broken bone or whatever it may be and be like, well, this happened a long time ago.
Yeah, they can look at your fingernails and see when you had like a lot of extensive history, like damage yeah. or...
And like, if like layers of your skin, not just the top layer, but the bottom layer is also like that bad, you know.
Yeah.
So there was a funeral service for Sylvia Likens, and it was conducted at the Russell and Hitch Funeral Home in Lebanon on the afternoon of October 29th. The service was officiated by Reverend Louis Gibson with more than 100 mourners in attendance.
So now you guys care. Now you guys are mourning there, but you couldn't do it beforehand. Sorry, I got...
Well, it's understandable... But it also goes back to what we were saying last week. People need to learn to speak up. If you see something, say something. And...
kick some butt.
There's not a whole lot that we can personally do, but reporting it could just be the one step. You know, if there's several other people that have reported it before you, then you could be the one person to maybe help make a change or whatever. So...
I am no encouragement of snitches. I have never been one. I never want to be one. I don't encourage people to be snitches. The only time I ever encourage it is this kind of reasoning with kids. And this sort of
abuse. If you see something bad, you should snitch. What do you mean snitch?
Snitches get stitches besides this.
Jeff, just don't ever listen to his advice, please. because if you see something, literally say something. I don't care if you snitch on someone. If they're doing something to break the law, you speak up.
So if I should report someone for stealing water from when it rains?
Collecting rainwater?
It's illegal in some states, some places. So you're saying I should snitch on them? Hey, Mr. FBI guys,
I'm all right, hello? Guys. Jeff is going to have stitches by the end of this episode, so...
Yeah, probably, anyway. Ow, I just threatened you. Ow, my eye. Stop hitting me, Kaylee. Ow, my pride.
I'm literally not even hitting him, please.
You're hitting my pride.
They're going to, like, call Adult Protective Services on me.
We literally told him to, you know, keep an eye out and, you know, report stuff, and now here you are doing it to me, so... No, we're trying to make a funny situation out of it. Not serious, funny situation.
No. So,
this is really sad. I know. Sorry for interrupting, guys.
With your stupidity. With our stupidity.
With my shut up, Jeff moment.
Shut up, Jeff.
Yes.
So Lycan's gray casket remained open throughout the ceremony, with a portrait of her taken prior to July of 1965 adorning her coffin. In his eulogy, Reverend Gibson stated that we all have our time of passing, but we won't suffer like our little sister suffered during the last days of her life.
Hmm. Don't cry, Kaylee.
Dang it.
Don't cry. Keep going. Just keep going.
Okay, okay. The Reverend Gibson then strode towards Lycan's casket before adding, "She was gone. She has gone to eternity." That didn't make it any better.
Just keep going, Kaylee.
Following the service, Lycan's casket was placed by pallbearers in a horse.
Hearse.
Oh, God.
A horse of a course. Put it inside of the horse. Like Star Wars.
Casket out the stomach. Inside the horse.
Look at my horse. My horse is amazing.
I'm so sorry.
Put a casket in it. It tastes just like raisins.
They put her casket in a hearse and drove it to Oak Hill Cemetery to be interred. This hearse was one of 14... Oh, my God, I'm sorry. This hearse was one of a 14-vehicle procession to drive to the cemetery for Lycan's burial. Wow, sorry. It's like Muriel.
Muriel?
From Courage the Cowardly Dog.
Muriel!
Her headstone is inscribed with the words, "Our darling daughter."
So, if they really care, they should have been there the whole time. Sorry, guys. I can't. I'm going to be one of those guys. I mean, just go worry about my, you know, my circus for a year or so. You'll be fine all by yourself.
Yeah. There's too much.
Everyone dropped the ball. Everyone dropped the ball.
Yeah. Truly. On December 30th of 1965, the Marion County Grand Jury returned first-degree murder indictments against Gertrude and two of her three oldest children, Paula, John Jr. Paula and John Jr. also indicted were Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard.
Yay! Pieces of trash!
All were charged with having repeatedly struck, beaten, kicked, and otherwise inflicted a culmination of fatal injuries to Sylvia Lycan's with premeditated malice.
Good. Send them all down.
Yep.
Put them all down. Like trash.
3 weeks prior to the filing of the indictments against the five defendants, Stephanie had been released from custody upon a writ of habeas corpus bond. Okay. With her attorney successfully contending the state had insufficient evidence to support any murder or culmination of fatal injury charges against her. Stephanie waived her immunity from any potential impending prosecution while agreeing to testify against her family and any other individuals charged with abusing and murdering Lycan's.
Of course she would now.
So this is quoted, this is a section of Paula's psychiatric evaluation detailing her indifference to Lycan's mistreatment. She, referring to Paula, represented the situation as one in which the girl Sylvia had become quite withdrawn and negativistic in her behavior to the extent that she refused to eat and showed no response to pain. At a formal pre-trial hearing held on March 16th of 1966, several psychiatrists testified before Judge Saul Isaac Robb as to their conclusions regarding psychiatric evaluations they had conducted upon three individuals indicted upon Lycan's murder. So the experts testified that all three were mentally competent to stand trial. Good job, guys.
That's awesome. Yes. Like, maybe they're all insane. Maybe it's a whole family that's insane. Or maybe they're just a horrible piece of crap family.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
They couldn't all have possibly been insane. Maybe one of them, statistically.
Maybe like one of the early kids.
The trial of Gertrude, her children, Paula and John, and Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard began on April 18th of 1966. All were tried together before Judge Rabb in Indianapolis City County Building. Initial jury selection began on this day and continued for several days. The prosecution consisted of Leroy K. New and Marjorie Wessner, who announced their intention to seek the death penalty for all five defendants on April 16th. They also successfully argued before Judge Robb that all the defendants should be tried together, as they were ultimately charged with acting in concert in their collective crimes against Lycans, and that as such, if each were tried separately, neither judge nor jury could hear testimony relating to a total picture of the accumulation of offenses committed. So
that's actually smart.
Yes. That was probably the best course of action.
All together or nothing at all.
Yeah. It really wouldn't have made sense
one at a time. Broken up. Because you'll get pieces of the story, like he said, you get pieces and you don't want pieces.
And they would have gotten off a lot easier.
Yeah.
So, each prospective juror was questioned by counsel for both prosecution and defense in relation to their opinions regarding capital punishment being a just penalty for first-degree murder and whether a mother was actually responsible for the deportment of her children.
Which I think it depends on. I think it depends on the situation. Some other things, you know, like this, I believe they're responsible for. If they steal something from, like, a store, it's kind of the kid's fault. Like, you should teach your kids not to torture, beat, kill a child.
But, so, jurors who expressed any opposition to the death penalty were excused from duty by Leroy New, and any who either worked with children expressed prejudice against an insanity defense or repulsion regarding the actual horrific nature of Lycan's death were excused by defense counsels.
Of course, they're going to try to find the perfect people for them, represent them.
I know.
We need someone who supports child beating and killings.
Perfect.
And who hates children, who hates fairness, and who loves insane people. So nowadays generation with Jeffrey Dahmer and them.
So the attorneys for Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and Paula and John Beniscusi, whatever, Jr. Claimed they had been pressured into participating in Lycan's torment, abuse, and torture by Gertrude. And Gertrude herself pled not guilty by reason of insanity.
You know, they already said that she wasn't insane.
Yeah.
So she's just a piece of
pretty much. And then Gertrude actually had a different lawyer than the kids did.
Well, that's because they're trying to say that it was her. The kids were saying it was the mom pressuring them into doing it, and they're saying no.
Which I think that she held
a higher. That's what the whole thing is. Should they get
trouble? She did have an influence, but at the same time, like,
they did have their own choice. They no, not yeah. today. Maybe tomorrow.
I don't know. Anyway, that's another whole conversation.
That's why they're trying to say. That's why they had two different lawyers.
So anyway, so. The testimony, one of the first witnesses to testify on behalf of the prosecution was Deputy Coroner Charles Ellis, who testified on April 29th as to the intense pain Lycans had suffered, stating that her fingernails were broken backwards, numerous deep cuts and punctures covered much of her body, and that her lips were essentially in shreds due to her having repeatedly bitten and chewed upon them. I guess that speaks for itself. But that part of it really got me, too. The fact that her lips were literally in shreds.
It was like towards the end of it, she couldn't think, she couldn't say the alphabet. So when they were trying to give her food, she's just probably biting her own lip too. Yeah. And doing all this stuff and getting hit so much. It's...
And then also being hungry.
Yeah.
And essentially starving. So Ellis further testified that Likens had been in an acute state of shock for between 2 to 3 days prior to her death, and that Likens may have been in too advanced a state of shock to offer much resistance to any form of subjected treatment in her final hours. Although he emphasized that aside from the extensive swelling around her genitalia, Likens' body bore no evidence of sexual molestation. Which, inserting a Coke bottle,
yeah, but there it's because they're going to get, they're using the testimony of the mom that she was loosey-goosey and doing all this stuff with guys and stuff.
Yeah, I know.
That's why.
And then, like, the fact that she literally was defenseless just makes this even more horrendous.
Yeah.
On May 2nd and 3rd, Jenny Likens testified against all 5 defendants, stating that each had repeatedly and extensively, both physically and emotionally, abused her sister, adding that Likens had done nothing to provoke the assaults and that there had been no truth in either the rumors she had been falsely accused of spreading or the slurs each had made against Likens' character. During her testimony, Jenny stated that the abuse her sister and to much lesser degree herself had endured began approximately 2 weeks after they had begun to live in the Banisuski household, and that as the abuse her sister was forced to endure escalated, Likens had occasionally been unable to produce tears due to her acute state of dehydration. She was so dehydrated, she could not cry.
Yeah.
And I think I'm overhydrated, so...
It's okay to cry, Kaylee.
Jenny burst into tears as she recalled how just days before Likens died, she had said to her, "Jenny, I know you don't want me to die, but I'm going to die. I can tell it." Sections of Jenny Likens' testimony were later corroborated by that of Randy Lepper, who stated he had once witnessed Likens crying, but that she had shed no actual tears. Lepper also testified to having witnessed Stephanie strike Likens real hard after her mother had ordered her to remove her clothes in his presence. He then visibly smirked as he confessed to having himself beaten Likens on anywhere between 10 and 40 separate instances.
These people...
Jeff, they know.
Okay. So this guy is probably like, I'm going to get a good deal for testifying against this person. But yeah, I beat her 10 to 40 times too. I can get my hands around.
On May 10th, a Baptist minister named Roy Julian testified to having known a teenage girl was being abused in the Banisuski household, although he had failed to report this information to authorities, as having been informed by Gertrude that Likens had made advances to men for money. He had believed the girl was being punished for soliciting. I'm not gonna go down that road. I need to get through this because Jeff needs to tell his story.
Then we have a happy story.
The same day, 13-year-old Judy Duke also testified, admitting to having witnessed Likens once endure salt being rubbed into sores upon her leg until she screamed.
That's horrifying.
Duke also testified to one occasion where she witnessed 10-year-old Shirley rip open Likens' blouse, to which Raymond Hobbs had made the casual remark, "Everybody's having fun with Sylvia."
Even the 10-year-old was abusing her. That... Okay, how about a joke, guys? How about a joke? I need to tell a joke, otherwise I'm going to freak out. So, you know this girl's named Duke, right?
Uh-huh.
Judy Duke. Do you think she had nice legs?
Why?
Nice legs, Judy Dukes. Makes the men go, woohoo. 303, anyone?
The following day, Gertrude testified in her own defense. She denied any responsibility for Lycan's prolonged abuse, torment, and ultimate death, claiming her children and other children with her neighborhood must have committed the acts within her home, which she described as being such a madhouse.
Of course she would. I don't know why the people would come to my house and do this to an innocent person. I have no idea why. No, you're the ringleader. Get over yourself.
She also added that she had been too preoccupied by her own ill health and depression to control her children. In response to questioning related to whether she had physically abused Lycan's sisters, Gertrude claimed that although she had started to spank Lycan's on occasion, she was emotionally unable to finish doing so and had not hit the child on any further occasions.
What about that, that thing that made it with the math degree? Remember that, what was that called?
The curtain rod?
Curtain rod, thank you.
The math degree? The curtain rod didn't have a math degree.
It did afterwards. That's so funny. Monty would be so proud of me.
Jeff, now I'm crying for a different reason.
At least you can cry.
Jeff!
Oh, I'm so messed up.
You're taking it too far.
Oh, no.
Don't. Just don't.
Don't stop.
We cope with humor. Don't come for us.
I don't know if we should keep this or not. It's not funny that someone got beaten and killed. I think we should cut it, though.
She denied any knowledge. Oh, God, I have to stop laughing before I finish this. Thanks for your jokes. She denied any knowledge of Lycan's having ever endured any beatings, scaldings, brandings, or burning within her home.
Of course she didn't. I don't know what happened. I was sad and depressed, and I did not do anything wrong. It was all the children. Yes, it was the children, not me. No, how about, lady?
Okay, 2 days later, Richard Hobbs testified in his own defense, describing how Gertrude had called Lycan's to the kitchen on October 23rd and stated to her, "You have branded my children, so now I'm going to brand you." Hobbs testified Gertrude had begun etching the insult into Lycan's abdomen before asking him to finish the task. Although Hobbs testified this act of branding had brought blood to the surface of Lycan's flesh and that Lycan's had begged him to stop, he remained adamant the section of branding he had inflicted had been light. It doesn't matter, bro. Hobbs further testified that he had initially believed Lycan's would not be at the household on October 26th, as Gertrude had informed him that she intended to get rid of Sylvia the day prior. So when Marie was called to the stand as a witness for the defense, she broke down and admitted that she had heated the needle which Hobbs had used to brand Lycan's abdomen. Marie also testified as to her mother's indifference to Lycan's evident distress in the relation to the physical and mental abuse she had increasingly suffered, with her mother's full knowledge, stating that on one occasion Gertrude had sat upon a chair and crocheted as she watched a neighborhood girl named Anna Sisko attack Lycan's.
So finally someone at least said something for the defense. Yeah. She still, was a horrible person.
Yeah. Marie added that although all five defendants had repeatedly physically and mentally tormented Lycan's, she had most often witnessed her mother and sisters committing these acts before her mother had forced Lycan's to live in the basement, where the abuse had further escalated and she had ultimately died. Another witness testified on behalf of the prosecution. Grace Sargent stated how she had sat close to Paulette on a church bus and had heard her openly bragging about breaking her own wrist due to the severity of a beating she had inflicted to Lycan's face on August 1st. Sargent testified that Paula had finished her boasting by stating, "I tried to kill her." So again, people who failed her, I lost count at this point, so. On May 16th, a court-appointed doctor named Dwight Schuster testified on behalf of the prosecution. When questioned by Leroy New, the exhaustive interviews and assessments he had conducted with Gertrude, she had been evasive and uncooperative. Dr. Schuster testified as to his belief that Gertrude was sane and fully in control of her actions, adding that she had been sane in October of 1965 and remained sane to this date.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Schuster was subjected to over 2 hours of intense cross-examination by Gertrude's lawyer, William Erbecker, although he remained steadfast that Gertrude was not and had never been psychotic.
So, instead of questioning, you know, her, he questioned the doctor.
Yeah.
So, doctor, you really are a doctor, aren't you? So, tell me, why do you think she's insane? Oh, because she murdered a child? Oh, you're just crazy. You're the crazy one. You need to see someone.
So, Deputy Prosecutor Marjorie Wessner delivered the state's closing argument before the jury on behalf of the prosecution. As each defendant, except Richard Hobbs, whose head dropped into his lap, remaining impassive, Wessner recounted that the continuous mistreatment of Likens had endured before her death, emphasizing that at no point had Likens either provoked any of the defendants or received any medical care beyond occasionally having margarine rubbed into scalded sections of her face and body. Referencing specific forms and means of abuse and neglect at the defendants' hands and their collective failures to either help Likens or deter each other from mistreating her, Wessner described Likens' abuse as stomach-wrenching and compared her treatment at the hands of all five defendants as being equivalent in severity to that committed against prisoners in Nazi concentration camps.
That's a big statement to say. Especially when all five of them are trying to pin it against each other.
That's rough.
And they're all trying to say that they did worse, And, you know, all the jury and everyone is just hearing it saying, oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then another quote from a section of Deputy Prosecutor Marjorie Wessner's closing argument is, "There's practically no fat on Sylvia's body. She hadn't eaten for a week. We'll never know the pain and suffering that Sylvia endured. The best evidence of that was the picture of her lips. Lips that were bitten into shreds." In reference to the premeditated nature of Likens' death, Wessner pointed to the jury's attention to the notes Gertrude had forced Likens to write on October 24th, stating Gertrude knew on October 24th she was going to hold these notes until she had the rest of the defendant. She and the rest of the defendants had completed the murder of Sylvia. Holding aloft a portrait of Likens taken before July of 1965, Wessner added, "I wish she were here today, with eyes as in this picture, full of hope and anticipation." Devastating. So, the defense, William Erbecker, was the first defense attorney to deliver his closing argument before the jury. He attempted to portray his client as being insane and thus unable to appreciate the severity or criminality of her actions, stating, "I condemn her for being a murderess. That's what I can do, but I say she's not responsible because she's not all here. She..." Okay. Erbecker then tapped his head to emphasize his reference of her state of mind before adding, "If this woman is sane, put her in the electric chair. She committed acts of degradation that you wouldn't commit on a dog. She has to be crazy, or she wouldn't have permitted that. You'll have to live with your conscience for the rest of your life if you send an insane woman to the electric chair."
No, send her in there.
I would plug it in and pull the switch.
Put all of her children at once. Make a group family photo. Put them on a big old couch. There you go. The biggest public execution of, you know, electric couch. There you go. Trademark.
Holding aloft an autopsy photograph of Likens, Erbecker instructed the jury to look at this exhibit, adding, "Look at the lips on that girl. How sadistic can a person get? The woman Gertrude is stark mad." Erbecker then referred to the earlier testimony of a psychiatrist who had called into question Gertrude's sanity before concluding his argument. Forrest Baumann began his closing argument in an openly critical manner as he attacked the decision of the prosecution to seek the death penalty for juveniles, stating, "I would like to have an hour of the jury's time to explain why 16-year-olds and 13-year-olds should not be put to death."
No. So...
Refraining from acknowledging the catalog of atrocities each had inflicted upon Likens, Bowman repeatedly emphasized his client's age, stating each was only guilty of assault and battery before seeking a verdict of not guilty for each youth. Foolish. George Rice began his closing argument by decrying the fact that Paula and the other defendants had been tried jointly. Sidestepping the multiple instances of testimony delivered by the trial describing Paula and her mother as by far the most enthusiastic participants in Likens' physical abuse, Rice claimed the evidence presented against his client did not equate of her actual guilt of murder. He then ended his closing argument with a plea of the jury to return a verdict of not guilty on a girl who had gone through the indignity of being tried in an open court. But let's just forget about Sylvia and all the indignities and all the things that she suffered and the fact that she died at 16. She no longer has a life, but at least they're still alive.
Yeah.
James Netter began his closing argument in defense of Richard Hobbs by referring to the loss of Likens, stating, "She had a right to live. In my own heart, I cannot remember a girl so much sinned against and abused. So much sinned against and abused." He then referred to Hobbs' courage in opting to testify in his own defense and the savage and relentless cross-examination to which he had been subjected by Leroy New. "They deserved worse, so you're not doing a good job of convincing me, Mr. Netter." He attempted to portray his client as a follower-type personality who acted under the control of Gertrude, suggesting that had he not carved part of the obscene insult into Lycan's abdomen at Gertrude's request, Hobbs would have been a state's witness as opposed to Stephanie. Netter ending his closing argument by requesting a verdict of not guilty, stating Hobbs was guilty of immaturity and gross lack of judgment, but not of the crime of murder. Leroy New rebutted the defense counsel's closing arguments by promising to speak through the mangled, shredded lips of Sylvia Likens, "I see wherever I look." Outlining the catalog of mistreatment Likens had endured prior to her death at the hands of each of the defendants, New directly addressed the criticism he had earlier received from Forrest Bowman in his closing argument regarding the prosecution, cross-examining children, stating, "The prosecutor's job is to present the evidence to the best of our ability. Now let's look at some of the responsibilities here. Each one of the five defendants had first and foremost the responsibility to leave Sylvia Likens alone. We had the responsibility to bring all the evidence we could find that could explain this crime." Exactly. Referring to the sentimental closing arguments made by various defense counsels regarding reasoning and motivation for their clients' actions, their attempts to divert responsibility to other defendants or participants, and their clients' collective failure to either help Likens or notify authorities, New added, "All we hear is whining appeal. Anything but blame where the blame belongs." I like him.
Yay!
He then speculated as to the reason Likens did not try to escape the household prior to the abuse increasing, increasingly escalating in the final weeks of her life, stating, "I think she trusted in man. I think she did not believe these people would do this and continue to do it," which makes me even sadder.
Yeah. So. She was like, she never argued, and she was like, she said, "Give the cracker to the dog and needs it more." Like, it was just her mindset. Like, she was tortured and, like, made to think that this way was the only way, and that she.
Yeah.
So sad.
New concluded his closing argument by emphasizing the defendant's unison in their collective mistreatment of lichens. Before asking the jury to dismiss arguments made by various defense counsels regarding who may have actually inflicted the final blow to Lichen's head, stating, "Every mark on that girl's body contributed directly to her death." And that was testimony. The subdural hematoma was the ultimate blow. This is the most hideous thing Indiana has ever seen, and I hope will ever see. Stating that not a shred of evidence had been produced indicting any defendant was suffering from a form of mental illness, New again requested the death penalty for each defendant, stating to the jury, "The issue here is not about the electric chair or a hospital, but about law and order. Will we shy away from the most diabolical case to ever come before a court or jury? If you go below the death penalty in your verdicts in this case, you will lower the value of human life by that much for each defendant. The blood of this girl will forevermore be on their souls."
Nice. I like this guy.
Yep. The trial of the five defendants lasted 17 days before the jury retired to consider its verdict. On May 19th of 1966, after deliberating for 8 hours, the panel of 8 men and 4 women found Gertrude guilty of first-degree murder, recommending a sentence of life imprisonment.
So there it goes. They don't care about life.
Nope.
Nope, of course not.
Paula was found guilty of second-degree murder. Hobbs, Hubbard, John, and John Jr. were found guilty of manslaughter. Upon hearing Judge Robb pronounce the verdicts, Gertrude and her children burst into tears and attempted to console each other, as Hobbs and Hubbard remained impassive. On May 25th, Gertrude and Paula were formally sentenced to life imprisonment. The same day, Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Jr. each received sentences of 2 to 21 years to be served in the Indiana Reformatory. In September of 1970, the Indiana Supreme Court reversed the convictions of Gertrude and Paula on the basis that Judge Saul Isaac Rabb had denied repeatedly submitted motions by their defense counsel at the original trial for both a change of venue and separate trials. This ruling further stated that the circumstances regarding the prejudicial atmosphere created during the initial trial due to the extensive news media publicity surrounding the case, impeding any chance of either appellant receiving a fair trial. The pair were retried in 1971. On this occasion, Paula opted to plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter rather than face a retrial. She was sentenced to serve a term between 2 and 20 years.
Of course she would.
Yeah. So despite twice unsuccessfully having attempted to escape from prison in 1971, she was released in December of 1972.
Kaylee?
I know.
So, Kaylee, I thought you said they all died.
Well, they do eventually.
Kaylee, listen. We need to go hunting.
Listen, Linda. So, Gertrude, however, was again convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison.
Of course, only life, not death. Hang this person. Shoot her in the head. Torture her. Sorry.
You need to listen. You're going to get more mad. Okay. Over the course of the following 14 years, Gertrude became known as a model prisoner at the Indiana Woman's Prison. She worked in the prison sewing shop and was known as somewhat of a den mother to younger female inmates, becoming known to some within the prison by the nickname Mom.
Okay, Susan B. Anthony.
Just wait.
I'm joking. Get it? Susan B. Anthony, get
it? By the time of Gertrude's ultimate parole, in 1985, she had changed her name to Nadine Van Fossen and described herself as a devout Christian. News of Gertrude's impending parole hearing created an uproar throughout Indiana. Jenny Lichens and other immediate family members of Lichens vehemently protested against any prospect of her release. The members of two anti-crime groups also traveled to Indiana to oppose the potential parole and to publicly support the family. Members of both groups initiated a sidewalk picket campaign. Over the course of 2 months, these groups collected over 40,000 signatures from the citizens of Indiana, including signatures obtained from outraged citizens too young to temporarily recollect the case. All signatures gathered demanded that Gertrude remain incarcerated for the remainder of her life. Within her parole hearing, Gertrude stated that her wish that Lycan's death could be undone, although she minimized her responsibility for any of her actions, stating, "I'm not sure what role I had in Lycan's death because I was on drugs. I never really knew her. I take full responsibility for whatever happened to Sylvia." Taking Gertrude's good conduct in prison into action, the parole board marginally voted in favor of granting her parole, and she was released from prison on December 4th of 1985.
Guys, that was a long, that was 10 seconds of silence. I'm about to punch everything.
I'm going to leave. Everything. Please don't punch me.
Apparently, I can get away with it if I go to Indiana. I can literally torture you and kill you, and I'd just be a getaway with it.
Well, that's Indiana in 1985, so.
Still, like, literally tortured a child. And they're like, oh, it's okay, just go, have fun. Like, yeah. This is why we need a revamp of the justice system, because people like that deserve to be shot. All right,
we can't, Jeff. They know. Following her 1985 release from prison, Gertrude relocated to Iowa. She never accepted full responsibility for Lycan's prolonged torment and death, insisting she was unable to precisely recall any of her actions in the months of Lycan's prolonged of her abuse. She primarily blamed her actions upon the medication she had been prescribed to treat her asthma. Gertrude lived in relative obscurity in Iowa until her death due to lung cancer on June 16th of 1990 at the age of 61. So she died fairly young.
I hope you choked and died in your own
Jeff,
blood.
Stop.
Okay.
Reflecting upon the news of Gertrude's death, the issue raised pertaining her sanity at both of her trials, John Dean, a former reporter for the Indianapolis Star, who had provided extensive coverage of the case, would state in 2015, "I never thought she was insane. I thought she was a downtrodden, mean woman." It doesn't matter what she was. She did what she did, and she deserved to die like poor Sylvia did. But Dean has also likened the case to William Golding's novel Lord of the Flies, although he has stated Lycan's increasing physical and emotional abuse was not a result of children going wild. It was children doing what they were told. So in reference to Gertrude's actual movie for tormenting and ultimately murdering Lycan's attorney...
Motive.
Oh. In reference to Gertrude's actual motive for tormenting and ultimately murdering Lycan's attorney, Forrest Bowman opined in 2014, "She had a miserable life. What I think she was ultimately about was jealousy. This was ultimately about..." Wow. So, after Paula was paroled in 1972, she assumed a new identity. She worked as an aide to a school counselor for 14 years, and having changed her name to Paula Pace and having concealed the truth regarding her criminal history to the school district when applying for the position. She was fired in 2012 when the school discovered her true identity. She reportedly lives in a small town in Iowa. She's married and has two children. Oh, so maybe she is alive. Maybe. Wait, hold on. The baby daughter to whom she had given birth while being tried in 1966, and whom she named after her mother, was later adopted. The murder charges initially filed against Gertrude, Gertrude's second eldest daughter, 15-year-old Stephanie, were ultimately dropped after she agreed to turn state's evidence against the other defendants. Although prosecutors did resubmit their case against Stephanie before a grand jury on May 26th of 1966, this decision to later prosecute her in a separate trial never materialized. Stephanie assumed a new identity and became a school teacher. She later married and had several children. Stephanie Sirikstad currently lives in Florida. Okay, maybe I lied when I said they all died. I remember reading that they all died.
I think we wanted them all to just die.
Maybe. Maybe it was just my own, like, fantasies materializing.
And how messed up that most of them became teachers or worked in...
With children?
Yeah.
When questioned at the trial as to her motive for turning state's evidence, Stephanie claimed, "I'm just here in the hope that I can help anybody."
Even though she was, okay.
But she wasn't as involved, remember?
She still helped in
it. I know. I was being sarcastic. In response, her mother's attorney, William Erbecker, sneeringly replied, "Including yourself." Following the arrest of their mother, the Marion County Department of Public Welfare, Shirley and James were in the care of separate foster families. The surname of all three children were legally changed to Blake in the late 1960s after their father regained their custody. Mary later remarried. Mary Shelton died of natural causes on June 8th of 2017 at the age of 62. Dennis Lee Wright Jr. was later adopted. His adoptive mother named him Denny Lee White, and he died on February 5th, 2012 at the age of 47. So some of them do die.
Mostly younger kids.
Yeah.
So all the ones who actually did all the horrible crimes actually survived.
Yeah. Richard Hobbs and Quay Hubbard and John Benwood Jr. served less than 2 years in Indiana Reformatory before being granted parole on February 27th of 1968. Surprise, surprise. Richard Hobbs died of lung cancer also on January 2nd of 1972 at the age of 21, 4 years after his release. So he got what he deserved. In the years between his release from the reformatory and his death, he is known to have suffered at least one nervous breakdown.
Wow, one. Imagine having that 5 times a day.
Yeah.
That sucks.
In the years, following his 1968 release from Indiana Reformatory, Coy Hubbard remained in Indiana and never attempted to change his name. Throughout his adult life, Hubbard was repeatedly imprisoned for various criminal offenses, on one occasion being charged with the 1977 murders of two young men, although largely due to the fact of chief witnesses to testify at his trial. Largely due to the fact that the chief witnesses to testify at his trial had been a convicted criminal acquaintance of Hubbard's, who admitted to having been in his company at the time of the murders, he was acquitted of this charge. So another murder that he was acquitted of.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Shortly after the January 2007 premiere of the crime drama film An American Crime, Hubbard was fired from his job.
So not all that, he didn't get fired, just because of that show.
Yeah, and he also died of a heart attack in Shelbyville, Indiana on June 23rd of that year at the age of 56. So, John Jr. lived in relative obscurity under the alias John Blake. He became a lay minister, frequently hosting counseling sessions to the children of divorced parents.
I think, wasn't he the youngest one of the...
Yeah.
So he actually probably could have been.
Well, he was involved.
Yeah.
A lot still.
Yeah.
Several decades after his release from the Indiana Reformatory, John Jr. issued a statement in which he acknowledged the fact that he and his co-defendants should have been sentenced to a more severe term of punishment, adding that young criminals are not beyond rehabilitation and rescribing how he had become a productive citizen. He died of diabetes in the Lancaster General Hospital on May 19th of 2005 at the age of 52. Prior to his death, he had also occasionally publicly spoken about his past, readily admitting that he enjoyed the attention the Likens murders brought upon him, and also claiming to have only ever hit Sylvia once. So, who knows? The injury to person charges brought against the other juveniles known to have actively physically, mentally, and emotionally tormented Likens, Anna Ruth, Cisco, Judy, Darlene Duke, Michael John Monroe, Darlene McGuire, Randy Gordon Leper were later dropped.
All these kids that they paid 5 cents to beat her, they all got dropped.
Yeah, eventually, I mean, it's weird because a lot of them ended up dying young. So, it's really strange. Jenny Likens, so Sylvia's sister, later remarried and was an Indianapolis native named Leonard Reese Wade. The couple had two children, and she actually died of a heart attack on June 23rd, 2004, at the age of 54. At the time of her death, Jenny resided in Beech Grove, Indiana. 14 years prior to her death, she had viewed Gertrude's obituary in a newspaper. She clipped the section from the newspaper, then mailed it to her mother with an accompanying note reading, "Some good news. Damn old Gertrude died. Ha ha ha. I'm happy about that."
So, I don't blame her.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, there's a lot that happened with them, but also the actual location that Sylvia was murdered stood vacant for many years, and it gradually became dilapidated. So, although they initially... They discussed potentially making it into a rehabilitation house and converting the property into a women's shelter, but they couldn't provide funds for that, so the house was demolished on April 23rd of 2009, and where the house once stood is now a church parking lot.
Interesting.
Very interesting. And then in June of 2001, a 6-foot-tall granite memorial was formally dedicated to Sylvia. In Willard Park, Washington Street, Indianapolis. So if you're in Indianapolis, you'll have to go find that and take a picture with it and send it to us.
Yeah.
So this dedication was attended by several hundred people, including members of the Likens family. The memorial itself is inscribed with these words: "This memorial is in memory of a young child who died a tragic death. As a result, laws changed and awareness increased. This is a commitment to our children that the Indianapolis Police Department is working to make this a safe city for our children."
So we should have done that in the first place then. Oh, sorry. What?
Yes, but sucks that it came at a cost, but...
Let's see what the law says now. Let's see what happens when you torture and kill a child. It should be death automatically. That's what it should be.
Should be.
So, wow, Kaylee, thank you.
I am so sorry it was so long.
Yeah, you had 2.5 hours, Kaylee. Can I please get 5 minutes in?
Oh, please do. I'm so tired of talking. You're doing a long one next week.
No, I'm not.
We're going to switch spaces.
I did that Jeffrey Dahmer one once.
That one?
That once. One. Yeah. We're already at an hour and something, so I'll make it quick, guys. So, here's my first little thing. Diana of the Dunes.
Diana of the Dunes.
The Dunes. Diana of the Dunes. Mm-hmm. So, fishermen first started reporting the sightings of a woman skinny dipping in the waters off Indiana's Lake Michigan coastline in 1916.
Scandalous.
And that's because Alice Gray, the source of the Diana legend, was still very much alive at that point. The exact circumference? Math again.
Oh, gosh.
Exact circumstances that caused her to live a reclusive life in a lakeside shack are entirely clear, but the years that followed saw her marry a man who later became a murder suspect.
Oh.
And then die on early death, allegedly from uremic poisoning. Ooh.
Interesting.
Her ghostly presence had been a subject of local lore ever since. Along the shores of Lake Michigan, fishermen, vacationers, and other passerbys have reported seeing sightings of Diana, a ghostly nude, scandalous, female apparition floating along the shoreline and eventually disappearing into the water without a trace.
Very strange.
Ooh, naked lady. You know what it reminds me of?
What?
Big Fish.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
That's very true.
That's very true. So, that's my first little one. Diana the Naked Lady.
Interesting.
The second thing I have is the Green Clawed Beast. Green Clawed Beast. Kitty. The Green Clawed Beast. Indiana just might have its own creature from the Black Lagoon. Through this report was only given on a single occasion. It is still one of the crazier myths you'll ever hear. Two women reported being dragged underwater by a green monster as they swam in the Ohio River in 1955. The clawed creature grabbed at one of the women several times, and she barely got away as it splashed and pulled.
Wow.
After word got out, there are many rumors and speculation as to what happened. Mm-hmm. A horror film in which something similar happens had just been released, though.
We have it.
Regardless, the women were later visited by a colonel for the United States Air Force who told them never to speak of the incident ever again.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I was like, okay. though no one has reported seeing this thing. What?
I spit on your phone.
Thanks, Kaylee.
Sorry.
I think that was me, though.
No, it was me for sure. I watched it happen.
Though no one has reported seeing this thing since, who's to say it could have swam into another connecting body of water like the one you're living or staying in right now. Oh. It went through the Ohio Ram and all the way down there, all the way through the one going through the Grand Canyon, and now they're in Lynx Lake. Let's go visit them.
There's no connective bodies of water, though. Anyway, whatever.
It might have feet.
Okay.
It might got in a fishbowl. I'm the green clawed beast that tried to grab you down. I think you are. I'm a beast. I'm a gangster.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, that's all I have. A nice little thing. You got a law?
Yeah, unless you want to do it.
Okay.
I think we were looking at the same list.
All right, so. Maybe. You want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
All right. First, I'll tell the law, and then I'll tell my story. Okay, in Elkhart, it is illegal for barbers to threaten to cut off kids' ears.
I feel like there's a story behind that.
I want to know the story. But my story.
Oh, gosh.
Is I went to Yuma.
Uh-huh.
And how can I say this without sounding rude? I was getting a haircut, and this guy, he was an old-timey, like, 1920s, 30s, you know, World War buzz. Like he shaved people's heads for, like, the war. So yeah. He was a hardcore guy. And so, you know, little me, all scared, getting a haircut, he's like, you'll be just fine. He took the pure metal old-fashioned razor and just started, like skinning the top of my head off. And I just was, like, freaking out because I could, like, literally feel it going against, like, the metal going against my skin. Like, you know when you shave, you got a little piece of metal, you get scared? He was going so far down. And I got so scared, and I just started, like, almost crying.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I was, like, bald. So I was crying on my way out, and my dad's like, stop crying, you know, stop, like, be a man, stop crying.
Yeah.
And then I touched my head, I'm bleeding.
So he made you bleed?
He made me bleed. He scalped me.
Oh, Jeff. He scalped you?
Yes. And I have, some sound the gross part, I have moles on me.
Yeah.
So he scraped one of my moles.
Oh.
So I was like, he's making me bleed, Dad. And he's like, just get over yourself. That's how it used to be. Imagine, it used to be a lot worse. They used to give you a shot of something, and then it would do it. So you didn't have a shot. You want one? I'm like, no, it's okay. Oh, God. I just want to go home and cry.
Oh, no.
So that's why I was like, got your ear, got your mole. That's why I was... I'm scared of barbers. Now you know one of my secrets, Kaylee.
No, now I know.
I know why I don't like. I like any haircuts, but I don't like any haircuts because I always have to like give them like, just be careful. I have sensitive ears, and I'm a big baby. I'm afraid they're cutting off my ear.
Big old
off,
baby.
I'm afraid of them like getting scissors and stabbing me in the eye or something. Or, like you know Sweeney Todd, right?
Yeah.
I'm afraid of Sweeney Todd. One day I'll just be relaxing, all of a sudden, bleed everywhere.
Because that's what he does. He goes house to house.
That's what you should do, honestly.
Honestly.
Traveling barber.
Yeah, that's true.
So, anyway, that's all I have.
Well, thank you, guys.
No problem.
We just wanted to tell you that we might have some sort of merchandise for you guys to purchase. I'm still trying to figure out how to do a website. So, if you have any experience with that, let me know.
If you want to make us a website for free... And be in charge of the website for free. Where we don't pay you we don't pay you or anything. We really appreciate that.
Jeff, stop.
If you want to be our minion forever, that'd be awesome. You might be able to talk in one episode. Maybe we'll see. One episode for like 5 minutes.
Maybe.
So, but yeah, we have merch.
Anyway, we're gonna be making like a bunch of stuff. So
If you have any ideas, what you want, any cool shirts, if you have any designs, if you want to draw something for us,
someone making stickers designs for us right now, and they're gonna be amazing. Like I'm so excited. I saw some sketches, and you guys have no idea. Even if you don't get them because they're a podcast, they're like amazing to have anyway.
They're gonna be awesome. So we have a couple. So, cool. So if you have any ideas, if you want anything specific, let us know.
Yeah. Seriously, we can make water bottles. We can make just about anything.
Make little buttons and pins and cool little stuff. Eventually, we have a lot of ideas.
Yeah, so just keep an eye out for that. Also, if you wanted to find more content, we have ghost hunting episodes on our Patreon. That's patreon.com/theUnitedStatesOfHorror. We're also the most active on our Instagram. If you wanted to follow us there, it's Instagram, it's at United States of Horror. And then we need your personal experiences.
I think we have one for sure.
We have a Camp Horror Campfire story coming up. It's in the next couple episodes. And if you want to be a part of that, submit your stories to UnitedStatesOfHorror@gmail.com. And then we have all our socials linked below. And you know where to find us.
Yeah, rate, like, subscribe, you know, share, do everything. Talk to us.
Subscribe.
Cry all the time. That's what I do. Anyway, guys.
Forgive me for being a big baby in the last two episodes.
Sorry, I'm so angry. We're getting help.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, we're not supposed to say that, are we?
No, it's okay.
No, we should. You should, honestly.
If you need help, get help. That's what I do.
Especially nowadays, it's crazy right now.
Yeah. For sure.
And we need to be more helpful and caring for other people.
Agreed.
Yes. So all stop right, being guys. Mean. Yeah, stop being mean.
Yes, be kind. We're going to leave the same outro, similar outros last week. Just be kind to your fellow man, woman, people. Person,
yeah.
Your animal, fellow,
dog. Be nice your to everything.
Fellow human. Yeah, just be nice. We need it so desperately these days. We really do.
Mm-hmm. So Jeff here.
Kaylee here.
And we are
the United States of Horror.
Horror. Stop.
I'm so sorry. I cannot sing.
We're keeping that in now.
No.
Forever.
I'm editing.
Are you?
No.
That was loud.
We're keeping that in too.
Or not.
If we're keeping my singing, we're keeping that.
Or not.
Exactly. All right. All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.